President Biden decides that America's military involvement in Afghanistan will soon come to an end. For many Afghans, that's a scary prospect.
I'm not saying the U.S. is responsible for the mess that we have. I don't want to blame them, but I think the job is certainly not done.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, in England, a new bill would grant police more power to deal with street protests. Not surprisingly, that's led to more protests.
And if you don't protest, things don't change.
And a genealogist looks for descendants of African-American soldiers missing from World War II. Her research has taken her through records where people were listed as property.
I don't care how long you've been doing it, you never get accustomed to seeing individuals mixed in with livestock and crops.
All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We start today on the ground in Afghanistan, a country known as the Graveyard of Empires. In the 1840s, British efforts to conquer it ended in disaster. A century and a half later, Soviet troops pulled out after failing to prop up a fragile government. The U.S. invaded to root out al-Qaeda, which planned the September 11th terror attacks, largely out of Afghanistan. Today, President Biden called for the departure of all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021.
In Kabul, Lotfullah Najafizadeh, who heads a Tolo news channel, says Biden's announcement has made Afghans anxious and that the 5 months left before the U.S. departure will be critical.
I think that's the window to get to peace. That's the only window left. And it is for Afghans, for the Taliban, for the region, and for the United States diplomatic efforts to really make a last push. But that's not what we hear from the Taliban. You know, the Taliban are very reluctant in terms of their engagement for a serious peace talks. They issued a statement yesterday that they will not get into a serious discussion in the upcoming Turkey summit, which is a bit of a disappointment indeed.
So what does that mean for Afghanistan after September 11th? I know some U.S. troops will remain in the country, but what is the Taliban likely to do after that?
We're not sure about any residual forces staying in the country post 9/11. That is something to be seen. If we don't get to peace, then we will definitely get into a very serious conflict again, which will, I think, the country will sink into some sort of civil war. So it's really, really crucial to stop that, to prevent that. And I hope that, you know, we get to peace by the last U.S. soldier leaving Afghanistan.
Could Afghan President Ashraf Ghani done more to have prevented this? Are we seeing the U.S. government throwing up its hands and just losing patience with the government there?
Yes, I believe we Afghans, our government included, you know, we're responsible for where we are and for the mess we have. And I think we could have done much more in terms of, you know, security, governance, also the peace talks. We were not really certain about, you know, the peace process in the past 2 years, even if the Taliban were serious or not serious. So I think it's a compounded problem that ultimately the Afghan people will pay the price. And I'm afraid this time the price will be much, much bigger and higher.
What does that mean? What are you worried about?
Civil war.
If there is a civil war, who comes to Afghanistan's rescue?
Well, last time nobody did. I'm not sure if, you know, it will be different this time, because abandoning Afghanistan in a situation pre-civil war, I'm not sure if it's really a wise decision. Even from a U.S. national security point of view.
Lotfullah, what do you think is the U.S. responsibility, its duty to care for Afghanistan after a war that they've been directly engaged in for 20 years now?
I understand all U.S. deliberations and dilemmas. I believe that any departure pre-peace deal, a sustainable peace deal, is a mistake. So I'm not saying the U.S. is responsible for the mess that we have. I don't want to blame them. But I think the job is certainly not done.
So if a conventional peace deal is not possible, what is the way forward avoiding a civil war?
I think we have to really give peace a last serious chance. So the next 4.5 months is crucial. All eggs should be put in the peace basket. I see no alternative.
Lotfullah, I'm curious to know what you make, what other Afghans make that you've spoken to, of the actual pullout date of September 11th, 2021, which will be 20 years since the attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and those four planes that day.
Yes, it's a political decision for political purposes, which I totally understand. This is not based on the situation and ground realities. And I believe 20 years down the road, of course, the country is transformed, but the country is as fragile as it can get to pre-9/11.
This is America's longest war. The U.S. has sent hundreds of thousands of troops to combat in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. More than 2,400 have died. A lot of Afghans have died. $2 trillion have been spent. How do you respond to people in the U.S. military and diplomatic corps who say this struggle is unwinnable? It's time to go home.
I think the country has come a very long way thanks to the sacrifices of U.S. Men and women in uniform, as well as others in the international community. And I think we could have done a much better job in the past two decades. And I think Afghanistan will be grateful for, the people will be grateful to everyone who made an effort, no matter what the end result is.
Part of this has to be also personal, Lotfullah. I mean, your agency, Tolo News, has done a lot of in-depth coverage of targeted assassinations in Afghanistan, especially recently. Killings by the Taliban that have targeted journalists and civil servants. Have you lost many close friends and colleagues just in this past year?
Yes, I've lost 11 colleagues in the past 5 years to direct Taliban and Daesh attacks. But of course, the United States has all the rights to make, you know, its own national decision. But I'm afraid the consequences will be grave for all of us.
Lotfullah Najafizadeh is the head of Tolo News, Afghanistan's first 24/7 news channel. He's been speaking with us from Kabul. Thank you very much, Lotfullah.
Thank you.
An announcement today from authorities in Minnesota. Kim Potter, the police officer who shot 20-year-old Dante Wright during a traffic stop, will be charged with second-degree manslaughter. Wright's killing touched off days of protests in Brooklyn Center, the suburb of Minneapolis where the shooting took place.
Say his name!
Dante Wright!
What's his name?
Dante Wright!
Say his name!
Dante
Wright! Wright's death, yet another case of an unarmed black man being killed by police here in the U.S. Once again, people want to know why policing in America can be so deadly while other countries do things differently. Our next guest has followed this closely. Paul Hirschfield is a sociologist at Rutgers University. Let's start with something that might seem totally surprising to American listeners, Paul. We know about the UK and Ireland, but they're not alone. There are a number of police forces around the world where officers are largely unarmed, right?
That is correct. You can add Iceland and Norway to the mix there. It means that officers on patrol routinely do not carry firearms. And there are typically officers at work somewhere in the proximity that are carrying guns, but the officers who are conducting routine police work would not be carrying any firearms.
What brought them to that policy decision?
I think the general rationale would go back to the founder of the London Metropolitan Police. I should say the architect rather than the founder, Robert Peel. And that is the notion of policing by consent, that the best way to achieve compliance from your citizenry is to have them respect law enforcement. And police who are unarmed garner more respect in general because it's seen that they are doing a service. They are putting themselves at risk. So I think that's a big part of it. Obviously, when you have strong firearm control, it makes it easier and more practical to have such a policy.
What does your research show about racial bias in policing and what the absence of guns does for police-citizen relations? I mean, because in the UK, racial bias still exists.
Definitely. That is evident with respect to their patterns of stopping people and searching people. Europe is certainly not free at all of all the forms of racism that are endemic in the United States. However, that racism is far less likely to manifest in police killings when you have police who are better trained, more restrained. So it just manifests in other ways as opposed to deadly force.
How does police training in the U.S. compare to countries you've studied, like training on the use of force, on racial bias, or on de-escalating bad situations?
As a general rule, police training in Europe is more extensive. I would say the norm is about 2 years. But with respect to the places where police are unarmed, like Norway, they have unusually long training. That includes 2 years of classroom training followed by 1 year of field training. So that affords National Police Academy plenty of time to give them training in the things we would hope they would get. Communication, multicultural relations, de-escalation, psychology, criminology, law, ethics, you know, rather than treating them as one day modules like you might see in the United States, police officers there have an opportunity to delve deeply into those vital areas, which equips them to resolve problems much more peacefully.
What reforms do you think would be most impactful across the United States right now?
We need to rethink the thresholds with respect to when police can use deadly force. We take it for granted, given the Supreme Court precedents, that a reasonable belief of imminent or grave threat is an adequate reason to use deadly force. But that is not the standard in Europe, and it's not the standard in Colorado anymore. The problem with that standard is oftentimes when police feel that reasonable fear, that is not justified. It's not informed by the actual circumstances of the encounter. So in my sense is that most of the time, the use of deadly force is unnecessary. For the purposes of protecting officer safety, we compromise civilian safety. Everyone deserves to survive police encounters, not merely the police.
Paul Hirschfield is a sociologist at Rutgers University and speaking with us about police forces around the world that are unarmed. Thanks very much for being with us today, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
Last December, Switzerland's parliament approved a law legalizing same-sex marriage. It did not go into effect immediately. Under Swiss law, if more than 50,000 citizens sign a letter opposing a parliamentary decision, it moves to a referendum. And this week, opponents of the measure delivered 59,000 signatures saying no to same-sex marriage. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The committee pushing for this referendum arrived Monday at the office of the chancellor in Bern with a show. They held signs promoting nuclear families, and two people dressed as a bride and groom delivered the 59,000 signatures. These nonpartisan organizers not only oppose the new law, they think legalizing same-sex marriage would actually require a change to the Constitution.
Also, es ist ja auch ein Rechtsgrundsatz, dass Ungleiches nicht kann mit Gleichem verwechselt werden.
Swiss politician Anjan Libron spoke to reporters outside the government building. He coordinated the referendum committee and says the term marriage has historically been used for heterosexual relationships. Same-sex relationships, Libron says, are something different. But this bill is about more than just marriage. It also expands access to sperm donations.
This bill is really about equality.
Olga Baranova is the campaign manager for an LGBTQ rights group supporting the bill. Sperm donation for queer couples concerns the opposition, who declined my request for an interview. They say it would mean, quote, the child's well-being falls by the wayside. Research shows the opposite. And according to polling done by Baranova's campaign, more than 80% of Swiss citizens support same-sex marriage. Still, she worries about homophobic backlash ahead of the vote.
We will hear and see a lot of homophobia. So I'm concerned about rainbow families. I'm concerned about all the LGBT or queer people in Switzerland because I don't want them to get hurt.
Baranova says LGBTQ organizations in Switzerland have been down this road before. Last year, the country voted to extend its current anti-discrimination legislation to include protections for LGBTQ people. She says homophobic attacks were an issue then, and they're preparing for the same this time around.
We know that even if you're just doing your campaign in the streets, doing some actions, organizing some events, that some people will react violently. It will be a huge issue.
A huge issue, but she believes a surmountable one. A counter petition has quickly gathered nearly double the signatures the opposition brought in, leaving Baranova confident that Switzerland will vote to approve the bill when the referendum is held this fall, ending, she hopes, a 7-year legal push for equality. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When a soldier dies in war, their remains can be the only consolation for a grieving family. Some families don't even get that. Consider this, the remains of some 6,000 soldiers who died in World War II have still not been identified. Around 50 of them are soldiers from the 92nd Infantry Division, the so-called Buffalo Soldiers, African Americans who fought in Italy in 1944 and 45. Current rules require a DNA sample from a relative before remains can be exhumed for testing. But now the Pentagon is considering a more expansive way to use DNA. In a moment, we'll speak with a genealogist about this. First, though, we go to Timothy McMahon, director of the Defense Department's DNA Operations, which oversees labs involved in identifying unaccounted for American soldiers.
What we're trying to do is modernize to meet the new technology that is out in the field. So in our case, when we're talking about past accounting remains, and those are remains from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, or the Cold War, these are remains that have been out in the environment for 70 plus years or have been chemically treated prior to burial. And so the DNA is vastly different than what is done with typical current day losses. What we want to do is take what Ancestry.com and 23andMe have brought to the table to assist with cold cases in your state and local crime labs and transition that, modernize it, and we have to optimize it to work with very, very damaged DNA.
So I get Ancestry.com and 23andMe. Can you talk about the technology that you're referring to, how it works and what it complements as a tool to identify remains?
So when an individual goes to Ancestry.com and 23andMe, they're using their DNA, they're looking at these identity markers, and they're asking, who am I related to? And that's a nuclear, what we call a nuclear DNA test. And that gives us a greater statistical ability to identify somebody. But current technology, for example, is if we look at the paternal line, if this missing service member had a brother and the brother is dead, but had a daughter, that daughter cannot be utilized to assist with the identification of the missing service member because it's a paternal niece. Under the new testing that we're looking to optimize using these single nucleotide polymorphisms, we can utilize that daughter now as a viable reference to identify that missing service member.
So you've been using Ancestry.com and 23andMe. Are you using those as examples, or would you actually use the data on those sites to kind of identify war remains?
So I use those as an example to give people a frame of reference. You cannot utilize Ancestry.com or 23andMe for this type of searching. And there's reasons. They're protected because the person is giving a DNA sample to it. There is an existing database that was referenced. The famous case was the Golden State Killer. And that is one where individuals freely upload their results that they've got from 23andMe. And you can actually search that if you need to. And that's what your state and local crime labs are actually looking to do, and they've been doing with what is called investigative genetic genealogy.
I think of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, that sacred site in Arlington National Cemetery. I mean, there are many countries that have similar monuments to the unknown war dead. Are we at a point now, Timothy, where there will never have to be such a place, that we have the scientific tools to name the dead from present as well as past wars?
We are at a place like that, and historically, if you look at the Tomb of the Unknown. Back in 1998, there were four families who presented enough evidence to the Secretary of Defense in regards to the Vietnam unknown to make a case that the Secretary of Defense allowed the disinterment of the unknown, the individual representing all of the unknowns for Vietnam from the Tomb of the Unknown. We had references for those four families. We did DNA testing, and the individual was identified as Michael J. Blasi. So currently in the tomb, there is not a representative of an unknown for Vietnam. So to answer your question is, through DNA technology, the constant evolution of new methods and the ability to open up more and more references, will we be able to identify everyone? The answer is, the technology is getting there through not just DNA, but through modern anthropological testing. But it all comes back to records, too.
Timothy McMahon is the director of the Defense Department's DNA operations, which is part of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. Timothy, thanks very much for explaining all this.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
The Pentagon relies on genealogists to find relatives of unaccounted for soldiers. Megan Smolignac is one of these genealogists. Her consulting work includes cases involving African Americans who served in World War II. Smolignac says in her work, she almost always confronts America's history of slavery.
Once you get back past a certain point, what genealogists refer to as the Wall of 1870. And we call it that because the 1870 census is the first census in which the formerly enslaved individuals finally show up under their own names and full names with surnames. So up until that point, it's about the same as anybody else. But once you hit that point, then you start hitting obstacles. Unfortunately, those who are enslaved were treated like property. And so you have to try to identify who the enslaver was and then dig into their paper trail, anything that lists their property. So you're mostly talking probates and estates, deeds, that kind of thing. It's uncomfortable research because I don't care how long you've been doing it, you never get accustomed to seeing individuals mixed in with livestock and crops and furniture. That's what happens, you know, in the estate records of these people.
So what you're saying, Megan, is that the history of slavery and Jim Crow laws really affect your ability to find past records on soldiers, I mean, soldiers from World War II, like from the 92nd Infantry.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But any good genealogist is stubborn. You need to just keep on dealing, you know, with the records that you can find. But you have to know what those records are. And it is gradually becoming easier. Many probate records, many estate records in different states have been digitized and indexed and put online over the years. But Ancestry, for example, only recently, they're going back and they're doing a complete indexing. What I mean by that is up until now, they've only indexed the names of the person who died and the person who administered the state. Now they're including everybody who was mentioned in the state. So you take an estate, say, from South Carolina, all of a sudden now those who are enslaved are going to be indexed, and that means that their descendants will be able to find them simply by researching.
I'm wondering if you can tell us about one soldier from the 92nd Infantry Division that you were able to find a blood relative for, what that process was like.
I can't share too many specifics just because of we always protect the privacy of the families. In all genealogy, you start with the present and you walk backwards in time. And so you start with a few details that you're given about the soldier. And you're also given the place that they enlisted from. But again, if you think about African-American genealogy and you know, the Great Migration, where they enlisted from, maybe they enlisted in Philadelphia, but they were really born in South Carolina. And that's mm-hmm. where most of their family are. So you have to figure that out. Once you start hitting brick walls, that's when you start digging into specialized records, especially if you do hit the wall of 1870, where all of a sudden you're having to deal with kind of the invisible aspect that was created by slavery.
Megan Smolignac is a genealogist who also consults with the U.S. Army to find relatives of those missing from previous wars. Megan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And this final note, the Defense Department has also kept track of U.S. service members unaccounted for during the Cold War. Between 1950 and 1969, 14 aircraft were shot down. The whereabouts of those 126 U.S. crew members, still unknown. You're with the world. The pandemic killed the tourist economy in Thailand. Now business people there have a plan to bring tourists back. They're creating a resort that should be free of COVID-19 by vaccinating all the hotel and service workers.
We have instinct to survive.
That's still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Back to our top story today, President Biden's decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan in just under 5 months. The U.S. first invaded that nation nearly 20 years ago. That happened because Afghanistan had provided a safe haven for al-Qaeda as it planned the 9/11 attacks. Matt Farwell was part of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. He served as a U.S. Army sergeant in 2006 and 2007. Farwell has written extensively about the country, including the book American Cipher, Bo Bergdahl and the U.S. Tragedy in Afghanistan. Matt joins us now from Fayetteville, Arkansas. It's been a while since we spoke with you, Matt. We've checked in periodically over the years, but let me just ask you first how you're doing.
I got to tell you, I think I'm doing quite a bit better than the last time we spoke. I got an injection in my neck called a stellate ganglion block for PTSD that really helped me out quite a bit in 2015. Stopped drinking, stopped getting arrested, stopped getting psychiatrically hospitalized, wrote a book, got married, and basically lived kind of a nice suburban quiet life. I'm watching my tulips come up in the spring and walking the dog.
No, I'm really glad to hear your life has taken that turn. What was your reaction to hearing all U.S. troops are scheduled to leave the country in September? How did you take this news?
I mean, on one hand, you think it can't come soon enough. And on the other hand, you wonder if it's actually going to happen at all, you know, or what form the U.S. presence in Afghanistan will take after the troops leave. Because I've started to think we don't really ever leave a place after we invade it militarily. We're, you know, still in the Philippines, still in Germany. I grew up as a military brat and grew up, you know, seeing the places that we would be in afterwards. So I wonder in 20 years, I'll be able to bring my family to Afghanistan.
What about the question whether leaving Afghanistan is the best plan? I mean, is this something you've been thinking about or talking with other vets about today or recently?
It's hard to watch the same cycle play out every year with the same, we're winning the war, we're rounding the corner, we're retaking Musa Calais again, and not get kind of cynical about the whole involvement. And now what worries me is not so much that we're leaving the war in Afghanistan, but that we've already imported the war in Afghanistan back home. Police militarization. While I was doing research for the book, I stood at a restaurant across the street from the Capitol building while a really well-scrubbed lobbyist in a $2,000 suit explained to me how he was really proud that he'd gotten every sheriff's department in the country an M113 armored vehicle that no sheriff's department needs. They have all the tools of war, stuff that was better than the stuff I used in Afghanistan is all back home.
So you saw combat in Afghanistan, Matt. Can you tell us a little bit about your time there, what you saw and what you know about the situation there today?
Sure. I was there now, as we look back on it, fairly early on in the war effort in 2006 to 2007, which was around the time that the Taliban, who had been driven out in 2001, they had gone, licked their wounds, regrouped, and were preparing to come back in and retake the country. So when I was there, there were about 25,000 troops total there. This last year, you know, looking at the inauguration and the amount of troops that went to Washington, D.C. for that, that was more troops than were in Afghanistan when I was there. And again, that was, you know, 15, 16 years ago.
So do you still follow the news today?
I don't follow it day by day. I don't follow it week by week. I follow the kind of main events and the big themes. And other than that, I gave it a lot of my time, sweat, blood, emotional energy. And, you know, some of that has to be given to other people now and other things. It's something I somewhat do my best to ignore, honestly.
I mean, that's understandable, but that time, sweat, and blood you gave, I mean, the work of the military in a war zone, it's hard work to say the very least. It's life and death. Does it feel like a full troop withdrawal is symbolic of an unfinished job? And is that disappointing in some ways?
I mean, I don't know if a full troop withdrawal being an unfinished job or keeping troops there for another 20 years is more of an unfinished job. You know, it's for me, again, it's 15 years out. I accepted 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago that it was largely wasted effort, you know, and it's sad to say that. And no one likes to say that 16 months of my life when I could have been blown up, killed, shot, you know, whatever else. And thank God I wasn't any of those. But, you know, it was kind of like pointless, wasted time. But, like, let's be honest, it was. You know, we didn't do anything good. We didn't change the country. We didn't make things better for anyone. And, you know, my battalion now has the highest suicide rate in the Army. We lose a guy on average every 2.5 months. You know, that doesn't scream that, you know, it was a great job that everybody feels good about to me.
I know some experts kind of feel that it's inevitable that the Taliban will take over, that there could be a civil war. Regardless of what happens next, what do you think the U.S. legacy is going to be in Afghanistan?
I mean, I think it's the same legacy that the Soviet Union left, the same legacy the British left, the same legacy Alexander the Great left. We got beaten by the people of Afghanistan. It happens. It happens to everybody.
Matt Farwell served in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2007 as a U.S. Army sergeant. He's been reflecting on the news that Joe Biden has ordered the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country by the 11th of September. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A shocking reminder there about veterans and suicide. If you or someone close to you needs to talk about this, there is help at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255. In cities across the UK, there's a chant that protesters have been shouting for about 5 weeks now, "Kill the bill." The demonstrators have been angry about proposed legislation in Parliament. If the bill passes, it would grant British police officers greater powers to deal with street protests. Critics say the proposed law is an attack on democracy. From London, The World's Orla Barry reports.
Back in September of 2019, thousands of climate change protesters occupied parts of central London. The group that led the protests is called Extinction Rebellion, also known as XOR. They disrupted busy shopping districts like Oxford Street and marched peacefully to the British Houses of Parliament.
We're very sorry to have you policemen tied up like this, but we're in the middle of an emergency and our government is doing nothing.
Activists glued themselves to the tops of trains and to the entrance of the London Stock Exchange. The protest went on for 10 days. Police made hundreds of arrests. But they said if the government wanted police to put an end to these protests, then officers would need more powers. British Home Secretary Priti Patel says the new policing bill would do just that.
Last year we saw XR blocking the passage of an ambulance on emergency calls, blocking airport runways, preventing hundreds of hard-working people from going to work. So this bill will give the police the powers to take a more proactive approach in tackling dangerous and disruptive protests.
The new bill gives the police the right to decide when protests should start and finish. They can set a noise limit for demonstrations. And if they think it's going to cause a public nuisance, they can ban a march altogether, even if it's just a one-person protest. Attorney Kirsty Brimelow has represented many climate change activists in court. She says the bill could effectively end street demonstrations.
If you think about it, that is really the core of protests. They are unruly, they're noisy, they can cause upset. However, that is part of the nature of what a protest is.
The government says policing protests is also a costly business. Brimelow says it might not just be the police who want officers to have extra powers.
There's also obviously undoubtedly pressure by businesses and by commerce who may not want their businesses disrupted. But again, rights can't be taken away or disproportionately reduced in order to protect the GDP of a country.
The bill has come at a bad time for British police. Just days before it was introduced in Parliament, officers were seen aggressively handling women attending a vigil for Sarah Everard. She's a young woman who was murdered in London in March. The man charged with kidnapping and killing Everard is a London police officer. Protests against the new police bill have since spread to cities across the UK.
We will not be silenced!
We will not back down!
We will not back down!
Former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed demonstrators in London earlier this month.
And if you don't protest, things don't change. Imagine Rosa Parks. Imagine Rosa Parks in the USA. She refused to accept the racism. Her individual act of bravery led to the civil rights movement, led to Martin Luther King.
But this bill isn't just about the right to protest. The proposed legislation has Gypsy, Roma and traveller groups in Britain worried too. Luke Smith is a Romani Gypsy from Surrey in England. Smith grew up in a house, but many of his relatives still live on the road. It's part of their identity, he says.
It's like a cultural thing. Like being in a house is like being in a prison, being tied to the land and you know, you're open for abuse.
Smith says there's a huge shortage of authorised sites where travellers can live in Britain. Under this new policing bill, occupying unauthorised land will now be seen as a criminal offence and it could land you in prison. Smith says this could destroy his community's way of life.
It's very insidious because when you put people's parents in prison for 3 months, what happens to the children? Well, the children get taken into care and our state already has a history of forcibly adopting our children. So that's basically what's going to happen.
The bill still has a number of stages to go through before it can be passed into law. In the meantime, protesters have vowed to continue demonstrating. After all, they say, it's not against the law. At least not yet. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Lebanon is facing an economic crisis, a political crisis, and now an education crisis. It's estimated that more than 1 million children are out of school. Many may never return because either they've missed so much or their parents can't afford to send them back. Things are even worse for refugee children living in tent settlements. For them, online learning is often not an option at all. There's little or no reliable internet or electricity. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with one family about how they're coping.
For the past 10 years, Daud Hassan Amr and her family have lived in a tent on the border between Syria and Lebanon. Over a WhatsApp call, Amr tells me about how they were forced out of their home in Homs, Syria, back in 2011. She says fighting broke out. Planes started bombing left and right. Her family had no choice but to leave. For a while, they moved around inside Syria, but eventually they made it to Arsal, a town in Lebanon along the border with Syria. And that's where they've been ever since. Amr gave birth to two more daughters in Arsal.
Sindo 16, Marwa 11, Islam 9, Sham 7.
So that's four kids between the ages of 7 and 16. Amr says she and her husband split up, and so she's raising the children by herself. She gets some financial help from the UN Refugee Agency, but money is tight, she says. Amr says her kids used to go to an education center in the camp run by an NGO, but it closed down because of the pandemic. And so for the past few months, her children have been getting lessons over WhatsApp. The problem is the family has one cell phone. Four kids, one cell phone. The pandemic has upended education for many children in Lebanon. But for Syrian refugees, it's even worse.
The stark reality is that even before the coronavirus hit, more than 55% of Syrian kids in Lebanon were not even going to school.
Bill Van Esfeldt is with Human Rights Watch.
And since the coronavirus hit, even the ones who were supposedly formally registered and enrolled in school really haven't been going and haven't been getting anything for well over a year now.
Under Lebanese laws, Syrians are treated as temporary migrants, not refugees or permanent residents. Hana El-Khali is an education expert in Lebanon.
Being a refugee by itself provides a lot of vulnerability. And being a refugee in a country that does not recognize you as a refugee, you know, adds to that vulnerability.
Syrian children outside of the camps, she says, used to go to public schools. They took the afternoon, second or third shifts. But as the economy got worse, El-Ghali says more Lebanese families started to send their kids to public schools because they couldn't afford private school tuition anymore. That put even more strain on public schools, she says.
Ahlan. Alhamdulillah, I'm 11.
Back at the camp, 11-year-old Marwa tells me sometimes homework assignments come all at once. So she and her sisters have to take turns. It's tough, she says, but she loves learning. Her favorite subjects are English, Arabic, math, and science. Do they have any problems getting online, I ask her mom. We did before, she says, but then I managed to save up some money to buy a router. Education over food, she tells me. That's how important it is for me that my daughters get an education. Dima Sokayar, an education advisor with the Norwegian Refugee Agency, says it's not ideal for Syrian children to be using their parents' phones for school.
It's sometimes difficult to have children submit their homework at a certain time or just for us to contact the children at a certain time because many parents work throughout the day.
So her organization adjusted homework hours to later in the day when there is a better chance that the parents are back from work. International NGOs are helping out. For example, in 2018, the UN donated about 8,000 laptops to Lebanon. But the Ministry of Education didn't have the licenses to run Microsoft Word on them. So two Lebanese companies agreed to store the laptops until the problem was solved.
And then you've got the Beirut port explosion.
Bill Van Esfeldt with Human Rights Watch again.
And 2,400 of the laptops were still stored in the port. And the Minister of Education goes on a tour to check out where the laptops are. And the company that was responsible for storing them in the port says, it's a tragedy, but they were all blown up in the explosion.
Fast forward 6 months, and the acting minister of education reveals in a TV interview that in fact the laptops were not blown up. They were sold for profit. The ministry said it's looking into the incident, and it didn't comment for this story. Mansfeld says Syrian children in Lebanon have already lost years of schooling because of displacement and war. and they can't afford to lose more.
These children are being robbed of their futures every single day. How do you have rights? How do you participate in your society? How do you try to build a stable, safe life if you can't read?
Marwa and her sisters tell me they're determined to keep up with their schoolwork, and they're even keen to show off their English skills.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Let me remind you of another way you can connect with The World. Start your mornings with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. You don't need to go looking for it. Our team will email it to you so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, at our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. In Kenya, the coronavirus has killed some 2,400 people. As in other parts of the world, most of the Kenyans who've died from COVID-19 were over the age of 60. And like other parts of the world, Kenya is prioritizing older citizens for vaccines. That's not just about keeping this particular population healthy. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi in Nairobi spoke with one of Kenya's elderly independence fighters who explained why he got his shot.
The Thika Level 5 Hospital was established in 1941, back when Kenya was still a British colony. 97-year-old Gito Wagahengeri is here for his vaccination shot. He's sitting, wearing a suit, and holding his cane. Gahengeri is the Secretary General of the Mau Mau Veterans Association. The Mau Mau was an independence movement that rose up against British rule in the 1950s.
The old people that liberated this country from colonial dictatorship and subjugation. I participated in that struggle for 7 years.
Those were tough times. Like many of Kenya's freedom fighters, he was eventually detained and sent to a brutal labor camp in a remote part of the country. Meanwhile, ordinary Kenyans were forced into detention camps and barbed-wired villages. Gahengeri explains why he and other freedom fighters risked their lives for Kenya's independence. It began with education, he says. Kenyans weren't allowed to continue their schooling past a certain grade.
As human beings, we can learn, we can read up to the last books of reading in the world. We must therefore find a way to educate our children.
Now Gahengeri wants Kenyans to make use of their hard-fought education to get their COVID-19 vaccine. He's happy to speak with a reporter about getting vaccinated in order to motivate other Kenyans, because many people here are hesitant about taking the AstraZeneca vaccine that's available.
This injection is preventing a person to die. If it is preventing you from dying, why can't you take it so that you can save your life?
He especially wants other Mau Mau leaders to get their shot. Irungu Houghton agrees. He's the executive director of Amnesty International Kenya. He calls Kenya's freedom fighters a national treasure, and he's worried they might be overlooked in the vaccine drive.
For the Mau Mau, many of them come from humble backgrounds. They don't necessarily have private health insurance, and therefore, if they get COVID, the likelihood is it could claim them in a way in which the British colonialists were not able to 70, 60 years ago. So that is why, you know, we need to be here today to make sure that the elderly, not just the Mau Mau, but our pre-independence veterans and our senior citizens are in the front of the queues for this vaccine.
Amnesty International is pushing for the Kenyan government to prioritize elderly people like Gito Wagahengeri. Only about 500,000 people have gotten their shots in Kenya. So with a population of more than 50 million, there's a long way to go. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
As COVID-19 continues to ravage the world, several places in Asia have stood out as success stories. Vietnam, Taiwan, Singapore, and Thailand had smart mitigation plans and, as a result, low numbers. That doesn't mean they're not hurting. Thailand, in particular, has an economy reliant on tourism, but with hardly any travelers, Thais in the tourist sector are out of work and desperate. The World's Patrick Nguyen has this report on an island in Thailand that's seeking a creative way to lure back foreigners without bringing in COVID-19.
Thailand is one of the most popular tourist destinations on Earth, and its most famous beaches are on Phuket, an island with crystal sand, palm trees, resorts. It's a gorgeous place. Before COVID, this small island would get 10 million foreigners coming every year. Now the place is practically dead.
That means 10 million visitors that we had were just gone, immediately just disappear.
That is Bumikit Rakdangam, president of the Phuket Tourism Association. He says people on the island are in serious pain. Almost everyone there works in the tourism industry.
People got no job at all. When you got no job, you got no income. And, you know, they have kids to raise, they have family members to take care of, and they don't know what to do.
Some are in poverty, going back to planting rice, taxi drivers and bartenders, working in muddy fields. It's rough, but most Thai people don't want to just throw open the borders to tourists. Mexico did something like that, and it has 200,000 COVID deaths. Thailand has only 97. The country needs vaccines before it can open, but the Thai government is moving slow. So far, vaccinating less than 1% of the population. Bumikit says people on his island can't wait any longer.
We understand the government may not have enough vaccines, so we want to buy ourselves.
We want to buy the vaccines ourselves, but who is we? Well, a bunch of business owners on the island who run resorts, bars, scuba companies, spas. They want to go on the free market, buy vaccines themselves, and give them to at least 70% of Phuket's population. An army of housekeepers, massage therapists, bellboys, and tour guides, all vaccinated and ready to go. They want herd immunity on the island ASAP.
The strategy comes from us, who are the businessmen. We have instinct to survive.
Right now, to come to Thailand, you have to quarantine in a hotel room for 10 days. No tourist wants to do that. But Phuket will be a special zone, Bumikit says, where if tourists can show they've been vaccinated in their home countries, they won't have to quarantine. They can walk around, go to the beach, as long as they stay on the island. They call it the sandbox concept.
It's a very basic concept. They would come to Thailand, especially Phuket, if no quarantines required.
But it's also raising questions. Like, they're really going to vaccinate some healthy 25-year-old tour guide before an 80-year-old grandma? Or why are business tycoons dealing with this health crisis and not the Thai government? Well, actually, the Thai government is now involved. Officials have handed over 100,000 doses of Sinovac, the Chinese vaccine, to get the Phuket vaccine drive rolling. The government might supply more, or the business owners might have to buy most of the other 800,000 vaccine doses. Bumikit says the cost of all this is not quite clear.
So we don't know the budget yet, but we're ready to go for it, whatever amount we'll take.
The Phuket sandbox will be open to vaccinated foreigners as soon as July, he says. That's the plan. He isn't sure how well this will work or if other tourism hotspots around the world will imitate the idea. But he says at least we're doing something.
We can't live like this at all. When we talk to anybody in Phuket, they would at least get hope back again.
That is hope they may need. After a long period with very few COVID cases across Thailand, suddenly this week there is a new spike and fears that the country will struggle to open up soon. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Here's hoping the whole globe becomes a COVID-free island someday soon. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. From PBS.